Well, welcome everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Over the next couple of days, I think I'd like to, well, in the next few minutes, present a general framework of what would be, I think, very useful to talk about. Of course, some of you I don't really know very well at all, so I really don't know too much about your practice and how you consider your practice to be. But I suspect, as what often happens a great deal with Dharma practice, that we do put a great deal of emphasis on sitting meditation. Very often we can think that it's really certainly the major part, or maybe it's the whole of the practice virtually anyway, with a little bit of ethics thrown in just to fill up the rest of the time. And I would like to maybe just paint a little picture of the possibility of actually taking that focus, as I say, that very often that quite deliberate focus on meditation, to actually expand it and take it into the rest of our lives, so that we don't see meditation as being, well, certainly the be all and the end all, but actually expand it to see that it's actually no different than the rest of our day, than the rest of our postures, so that we develop an equanimity throughout the whole of the day, from when we wake up in the morning to when we fall asleep at night. So there's an equanimity that we can cultivate throughout the whole of our day. So that's what I like to do. But before we get to that, you know, you may consider coming here as just a sort of an exercise in taking on board some information that, you know, you can take away with you and think about, and maybe slowly take it into your practice. But I think it's very important to see that just this coming together, actually, before we even speak, is actually very, very fundamental to what we are basically doing. We come together as a group, as a group of individuals. We've all got our own little ways of doing things and our own little characteristics. But if we can come into a situation like this, which is a very rare opportunity for practitioners to come together and to seriously practice in a very controlled, committed way for a couple of days, really take that to heart, and rather than come with the idea, you know, I'm going to go there and I'm going to listen, I'm going to take notes and think and stuff, but actually come with a spirit of helping and supporting each other. Consider this to be one, not a group of individuals, but we actually come here together. We agree to take on the schedule, and we take on the form, and we're here with a spirit of support. If we all put that in, if we all in some ways, or as much as we can, sort of leave ourselves at the front door with our own sort of selfish interests, and come here with that spirit of actually helping each other by, as much as possible, surrendering to the form, surrendering to the schedule, surrendering to the timetable, and to create this really strong, solid unit, so that we are actually practicing as one, not as a group of individuals, but we're actually as one. And with that spirit, that gives terrific strength. This isn't just a group of individual strengths, but it actually becomes one strength. And this is the great virtue, the great wonder of collective practice, is that it can be incredibly supportive. So if we take this very much to heart over the next couple of days, that we're not coming here for ourselves, but we're coming here for each other, and to put ourselves into that oneness with each other, there is terrific strength there. So if by chance anyone has any difficulties over the next couple of days, maybe as the day goes on, maybe the sitting gets a bit tight, a bit of restlessness, that people can draw on that strength when they want to fidget around or just do something different in some way. That collective energy, that collective strength can be very, very supportive. And if you consider that you're actually putting into that and contributing to that collective strength, then maybe we'd be less inclined to do our own thing, as it were, but to actually say, well, I'll just give that up for today, and we'll act as one. And that's the value of this, because if we're just going to be doing this for ourselves, then there's not really a lot of point in being here. We could just sort of do this at home. This is the value. This is this very unusual situation. It's a very, very precious opportunity, because these sort of things don't happen that often. And who knows the future? Who knows if there's going to be another one? So, you know, treat it as something special and a great opportunity to actually give yourself up, to actually just all your little resistances and little restlessnesses, just give them up for the good of everybody, because we're here to help each other. And then when you need that strength, when you have that difficulty, then you can draw on that strength. So to me, this really very much epitomizes the Bodhisattva ideal, in that we do truly practice for each other and put into the whole, but at the same time we can also draw on that strength for ourselves. So this is the wonder of this, that it's both for other and it's also for self. And I think it's something really worth pondering and taking on board for these couple of days. And the way that we keep the form is that we keep to the schedule. It looks slightly complicated with some sort of fuddy times, but if we can try to memorize as much as possible, and this is very, very important that we actually stick to these times and do our best, especially the sitting times, to make sure that we're back and we're sitting, we're not in the position in the meditation room several minutes before we actually need to sit before it starts, so that we're helping each other, we're bringing that energy, we're supporting each other, we're not just thinking of ourselves. And to help us keep that mindfulness, that awareness, that willingness to help each other, silence is a very, very, very important tool in this exercise. So if we can maintain silence throughout the day, except of course during the discussion times, but when we're sitting, and including lunch and the tea breaks, if our tea breaks are separate from our discussions, this helps to nurture, it helps to keep us contained. It helps us to remember that we're actually here as a collective exercise. My teacher in Sri Lanka told me once that silence was the highest blessing, and it's something very profound about silence, and it's very good to observe it. Not easy to do, but we can. So if we can start the next couple of days with that spirit, and we have that as a nice sort of collective framework, and from that framework we can then freely move within it, without losing ourselves, without the framework falling to pieces, where we all suffer, we all lose out on the benefits. So I think that's what I like to say at the start. So if we can sort of bear that in mind and take that as the sort of outer perimeter, the walls of what may happen over the next couple of days. And also just one other little pointer, in some ways this ties in with the silence, that the more open-minded we can be over the next couple of days, this is not an easy thing to do, but it's a good thing to bear in mind and to try and nurture if possible, is to try and listen and open up to what is being discussed over the next couple of days with a spirit of openness. Like try to be like an empty vessel, and what goes in can freely pour in, unlike our normal mind that tends to get involved with dialogue or starts to become opinionated about things that, oh, I know this and I know, oh, I don't like that, and what's he talking about, and you know, all the negativity, and that dialogue that we can engage ourselves with ourselves, that actually what that serves to do is it actually blocks the Dharma, it stops the Dharma. When the Dharma is actually coming in, it's actually something incredibly delicate and very, very, very subtle. And if you have a busy mind and you have an objecting mind, a negative mind, any sort of a mind that's engaging with, it's like playing table tennis, you know, you're forever knocking the ball as it comes to you. Put the bat down and just allow the ball to come to you. And try not to think about it too much. This may seem a bit strange, but the Dharma has this quality that if you just open to it and allow it into yourself, not into your mind, but actually into your body, into your being, you may well forget it. But it has this wonderful quality that when you're still and quiet, you actually don't forget any of it. It's all there, and it's there waiting to be tapped, if you like, or waiting for the conditions to be ripe, so then it will naturally rise up from within you, and you will remember things that you thought that you forgot. And that Dharma then is coming from your heart, it's not coming from your head, it's not coming from your discriminating intellect. And it has a completely different quality. And it has a lot of depth and a lot of strength. And it's that sort of Dharma that we should really be trying to nurture rather than something intellectual. This is not easy to do, but at least if you can take the theory on board and just learn to work with that and be alive to it and be aware of it, you'll find it so much more useful. I think the thing that we all have in common, whatever our practice may be, and the one thing that we all have in common is that we actually all do meditate, hopefully daily, but we all pretty much got a fist of meditation. It's the one thing that we learn, whatever our technique may be now, whether we're doing samatha or vipassana or both, or maybe in some cases neither. We do have this common ground of having some understanding of meditation. So I think it might be a good way, as that's the common ground, is that we can lead into the bigger picture, as it were. So our meditation, just to, without getting into specifics, into techniques and themes, obviously we're trying to concentrate. That's the basic. Still the mind and to concentrate. As I say, whatever method we have, is secondary to the primary objective of concentration. So let's say that I'm sure something that we've all done, if we don't do now, say that we count our breath, which is pretty basic samatha practice. So we launch ourselves into counting our breaths, and pretty soon we discover how difficult it is. We get to one, two, who knows, we may even get to three before we wander off somewhere or other. And then we catch ourselves with our awareness and bring ourselves back to number one again. And then we're off again, one, two, three, whatever. And then we're off again. We lose ourselves and we catch ourselves and we bring ourselves back again. With the object of staying with the counting as mindfully as possible, for as long as possible, so that the mind stills. This is it in a nutshell, I guess. So what we're doing actually then, when we're sitting, we are actually engaging in an activity, in inverted commas, of mindfulness, of actually staying with what we actually happen to be doing at that moment, which happens to be counting. We wander off, we come back, we wander off, we come back, but we know that for the 30 minutes or 40 minutes or 60 minutes, whatever it is that we sit, this is what we're doing. This is the object of the exercise, is to stay with what we're doing at that particular moment. I think that's pretty basic, and I think everyone, you know, would agree that that's it really in a nutshell. So how does that differ? You know, in Buddhism, doctrinally, we as beings have four postures. We're sitting, standing, walking, and lying down. That takes care of our life, of our physical experience. So we cultivate this mindfulness in the sitting posture, and somehow we seem to put an awful lot of emphasis on this sitting posture, and very often we don't really think too much about the other three postures, which happen to take up 23 hours of the day for most of us, whereas we sit for an hour, say. And somehow we don't see the rest of our day in the same way that we see our meditation. We can put this effort and this energy into concentrating for that time of sitting, but somehow when the sitting's finished, somehow that's the end of it. Okay, we may have some sort of an ethical practice where we go off and we try to be at least sort of half human in the rest of our day. But Dharma practice and Dharma change, the Dharmic change that we're all after, we're all after change. We all want release, we all want an end to suffering, can only really be achieved when we have a practice of equanimity throughout the whole of our day. It's no good just turning it on and turning it off whenever it suits us, which is, you know, for the period of meditation. We have to learn to nurture this commitment, this concentration that we somehow can muster up for our meditation period, but somehow we can't muster up or even attempt to muster up for the rest of our day. So when we embark upon our day, let me give an example. We've had the example of counting the breath when we sit. So when we wander off, we catch ourselves and we come back to the counting. Let's say, just an everyday example, say, of maybe cleaning our teeth. Do we put that same amount of effort and energy into staying with cleaning the teeth? I mean, we can clean our teeth and we can start and finish and be completely unaware that we've actually gone through this exercise. And we don't really necessarily think that it's particularly important. We can put the effort into when we're sitting on our cushion, because we know that we're supposed to be doing that. But somehow these other sort of menial everyday activities we don't really consider to be important, or maybe we don't just simply can't be bothered to put the effort into. Well, it's things like this that we have to learn to focus on much more. The reason why we can't, as we all know, the reason why we can't stay with these simple activities is because our minds are chattering away. And very often our minds are very much caught up with not just simple sort of neutral chattering, but quite often we're caught up very often emotionally with things that we're thinking about, either people or about ourselves, our relationship with ourselves or our relationships with other people. So that there is very often quite a lot of emotion that's engaged, and the more emotion that is engaged, the more difficult we find it to be mindful. So if we really look into this and really try to get to the bottom of why we can't seem to stay with the simplest of things, I think we find, what I found and a lot of other Buddhists have found, that the basis of the problem why we can't really stay with what we're doing is that we are caught quite often with our emotions. Our emotions seem to drive us very, very readily. And the more our emotions engage, the more blind we become, the more we lose our awareness, the more we get caught up, and of course the more we suffer. So it's very important that we learn to transform the emotions. They are in many ways, you know, it's almost like a wild animal that just seems to possess us and we have very little control over. And it's this that then becomes the primary focus in terms of transformation, which is what Dharmic practice is all about. So if we can imagine a situation, cleaning the teeth tends to be quite a simple, neutral thing that we don't have too many hang-ups about, really. But let's think of something else that maybe does engage our emotions. Again, maybe let's go back to getting up in the morning. Let's say, you know, we go into the kitchen and find that there's no milk for the tea or the coffee, or there's no coffee or something. Maybe we're living with other people. We all experience this, but then maybe, I'm not saying, suggesting that this happens with anybody in this room, but I think we can all see this as a possibility, that we can actually really get quite angry. We can engage, maybe if we're on our own in the kitchen, we can start thinking about the person who drank the milk last night and didn't think about me in the morning with my coffee, and then sort of engage in some sort of mental scenario with the person and get really, really quite emotionally wound up about these, about something like that. Or maybe the person will end up coming into the room, and then of course I'm not suggesting anyone here does these things, but we can engage with that person and get very upset, and we could end up exchanging very sort of harsh words with each other. And that's all very much emotionally driven. We get caught in something, we quit something that has taken our control away, something that is impinged on us, that we're not getting our way. I want my tea, I want my coffee. You know, you and your thoughtlessness have taken this away, and I'm extremely angry. What we learn to do is learn to contain that emotional outflow. Now, we are creatures of habit, and we will quite naturally engage mentally in that scenario, feeling sorry for ourselves, getting angry with the other person. But rather than engage with the emotion that goes with that and allow that emotion to rise up, take over and take us away to the point that we forget ourselves and we can become incredibly destructive lose all self-awareness with that emotional drive. These are the old habits that we've engaged in, that really have dominated our lives, that we've really become quite enslaved to, that we just don't seem to be able to do anything with. It's that emotional drive. It's the key. It's the absolute key to all of this. It's not the thoughts, it's not the pictures. It's that fire, that energy that drives those thoughts and those pictures, that inflames them, that makes them into the monsters that we can often become. So this is what we learn to focus on. Not so much the pictures and the thoughts, because we have very, very little control over those. So rather than try to alter our thoughts, we try to contain the emotion, because it's the emotion that gives these things life. And if we can transform that which gives them life, then they will naturally take care of themselves. So we begin to focus on the emotional drive that creates this world that we actually create. And we've all got our own little worlds. We don't all react when somebody drinks the milk. Some people are quite okay about it, and other people will go crazy over it, which just shows that it's our world, isn't it? There's nothing sort of absolute about it. It's what we create for ourselves. So that's really the world creator. It's the thing that gives the world life, power, volition. And through, supposing we're having our cup of tea without the milk, this is very much the same way, it's very much the same as counting your breath. So when you're drinking your tea, you're having all of this, you're losing your awareness of that simple activity, because you have this driving force that is taking you away from that simple activity. And then you catch yourself and you bring yourself back. Can you see there's actually, in that sense, there is no difference between sitting on the floor, counting your breath, and drinking a cup of tea. But what's the primary factor in not being able to just stay with that simple activity, as I say, is that driving emotion. So what we do through the awareness that we've got is that we learn to contain that driving emotion, which means that rather than allow it to just rise up and take over and take us away, through our awareness we learn to keep it. And emotions, as I'm sure we all know, are primarily in the body, and they're primarily in the lower part of our body. This is where they're born, this is where they manifest, this is where they come alive, and this is where they spring from. So if we can, through our awareness, learn to stay in our body, stay in where that emotion is coming to life, and learn to contain it. Containing doesn't mean suppressing. Containing means opening to it, allowing it to be. Don't play with it, don't become opinionated with it, just leave it, but learn to keep it in its place. Don't allow it to inflame you, don't allow it to rise up and take you away. And over time, energy is dynamic, it's alive, and energy always has to move. It can't stay stagnant. And if you can contain that energy and not allow it to flame the habits that we've all got and fall back into our usual way of reacting, if we can actually contain that outflow, it will transform. It will go into change. It's energy. It's volatile. It has to do something. It has to go somewhere. And if you don't allow it out through in that normal way, that energy will actually turn over. and no longer inflame and no longer possess you in the way that it's always possessed you. Now that energy is very much, that emotion is very much, and this is a very, very important factor, is very much in the body. This is not mental. This actually, when you engage with this containment in a situation, you will find, when you look at it, when you want to describe it, you say it's very much a physical practice, much more than the mental one, because you're containing this fire that inflames. That when you understand more and more, you see that it's the thing that creates all the destruction in the world. It creates all the destruction for ourselves and for others, and creates the dukkha, and creates the becoming. And the more that you can contain, the more chance that this has of going into change. And when it truly goes into change, that world that we create, in the destructive world, the samsara that we actually create, that will actually transform, and it will actually turn over, and samsara will quite literally die. But the important factor within this, as I say, is that it is very much more of a physical practice than a mental one. And what it requires is a lot of self-awareness, because these things can take off at a moment. Somebody can walk by and stand on our toe, and instantly we're off back into an old destructive habit. And this is the wonder of awareness, of being aware of yourself as much as you possibly can. When you're in that state of awareness, you have that moment before that awareness possesses you and takes you away, that fire possesses you and takes you away. You have that moment to catch it and learn to stay with that. Just contain it and keep it within your body. And through time, this is how the transforming process takes place, and it's the true transforming. And through, you will see more and more that the necessity to be aware, to be with yourself as much as you possibly can, and to bring that awareness into your body. Awareness actually isn't in your mind. It may seem that way, but the more you become familiar with awareness, and the more you understand awareness, you actually see that it's not actually in your mind at all. You'll see that it's actually much more in your body, strange though that may seem. This is how deluded we've become. We think that we're all up here in our head, but we're actually not that at all. And that awareness actually is, as I say, is very much more in your body. And that emotion, that fire, that is the basis of our suffering, also is in the body. And the more you look, the more you will see that that emotion and your awareness are actually very much in the same place. So if you can more and more cultivate coming back into your body and staying in your body and coming as low as you possibly can within your body, you'll become much, much more into the heart, into the centre of the whole dharmic practice and process. It's like you then begin to develop a dharmic environment, and that environment's in your body, and that environment, as I say, is very much in the lower part of your body, where your emotions tend to gather, manifest and gather. And through your awareness, the magic of awareness, if you like, or the miracle of awareness, the more you become aware of yourself, the more you begin to investigate and you begin to look into yourself. And that awareness, that the awareness and the emotion being in the lower part of your body, the more that we can stay there, and the more that awareness actually, you begin to investigate yourself more and more, and you begin to see that actually the whole dharmic process and the whole samsaric process is actually in your body. It's actually is not really in your head at all, but is very much something that's actually inside of you. And the whole dharmic process of change actually then begins to take place, A, through containment, and B, through beginning to investigate yourself. So that in time, this is how the transforming process actually takes place. Now, to me, I mean, this is a very, very mild light sketch of the actual process. But I hope over the next couple of days, you know, as we all engage more and more with ourselves with this, that we can actually see that our practice can actually be brought back into our body, and the difficulties that we have and the difficulties that we have with practice can be looked upon and hopefully understood through that form, through that picture, through that way of approaching the Dharma, rather than the mental process, which this most certainly is not. So within the process, let me try and bring it back to the just finish this off with how in fact we practice the Eightfold Path, which is what we're all doing to one degree or another. This is the dharmic path. Is that we're learning to concentrate. Our awareness and our mindfulness is all about concentration. And that concentration is only possible if we learn to nurture our ethical practice. And through that containment and through the ethical containment, we can actually begin to understand ourselves, look into ourselves and begin to understand ourselves. And there, in very rudimentary terms, we actually have the Eightfold Path, if you can see that. And that whole nurturing process, that process of change, which is about understanding ourselves, takes place within that framework of the Eightfold Path. And that framework is very much more of a physical framework than a mental framework. And it's in that containment and in that awareness that we actually begin to understand ourselves, and we begin actually to make friends with ourselves through containment and through not buying into our old habits. We're actually engaging in a process of accepting ourselves rather than reacting to ourselves. And what we're really doing in that process is actually we're learning to make friends with ourselves. That's really all we're doing, actually, ultimately, in this Dharma practice. You know, when we come to Buddhism, or we can go into a Buddhist library and see rows and rows and rows of hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, I don't know, maybe even millions of books on Buddhism that just seem to go on into infinity, and incredibly complicated and incredibly metaphysical, and we can read the, you know, especially the Mahayana sutras and the imagery that they create, and we can look at all this, we think, wow, this is just so incredibly complicated and difficult, and how can I possibly practice this, and we seem to find a need to actually understand all these things that we come across. But actually, the whole dharmic process, the whole transforming of our suffering, of our negativity, the transforming of the whole samsaric world, is a process of nothing more, absolutely nothing more, than making friends with ourselves. That's all we're doing. It is not complicated. If we look at ourselves, we see that for so much of the time we're in conflict with ourselves over whatever, and also in conflict with other people. And we spend so much of our lives engaged in that conflict. And that's the source, that's the basis of our dukkha. And all of that comes out of non-understanding. And the way forward and the way into understanding is to learn to open and accept and to embrace all of that conflict that goes on with us, and not to engage with that conflict, but learn slowly through opening, through not being judgmental with ourselves, slowly what we're actually doing. And you can dress this up in any way that you like. All we're actually doing is actually making friends with ourselves by learning not to engage in the conflict that we've always engaged with. So if you take this as a basis, as a fundamental principle, the simplicity of it, of learning to contain our habitual outflows, our habitual engagement, very often negative, with ourselves and with other people. Learn to contain that outflow. And in that containing, what we're actually doing is that we are learning to make friends with ourselves. And it really is as simple as that. And all the difficulties that we have within the practice really does stem from that basic non-understanding. So hopefully after tea we could start maybe to discuss. This is a very, very brief sketch, and I don't know how clear it was. I think it could have been a little bit clearer, but anyway, it's a start. And really try to see it as something personal. Don't sort of engage with this as an intellectual process. Try to see your own difficulties with these simple everyday things and why it's so difficult to just accept and to not be so reactive all the time with these things. This is where we really need to be working on this space here, so it becomes something very real and very alive. So this is not just a theory. We're not just taking on board more conceptual ideas, but we're actually putting it into practice on a daily basis in our simple everyday world. And we learn to nurture the practice through our simple everyday things, as well as our meditation, of course, but also through the rest of our day. And just really bring the whole thing down to earth, down, put it down on the ground, so that we can then just toss it around and see how we get on. And I think something like that is, it'd be a lot more useful than just engaging in more concepts and ideas about practice. So maybe we should pause for a moment and have a cup of tea. That was a very, very brief outline. Really, what I'm trying to do is to try to keep our time together really quite focused. I know how these things are, and we can go wandering around all over the place with Buddhism and Dharma and all the rest of it. But I really would like to try and keep it very grounded so that everyone can see themselves in it and be able to reflect on their own sort of relationship engagement with the practice. So that was a very, very, it was hardly a skeleton really. I don't know if it made a lot of sense, but just to try to keep it as a focal. So if we can keep our discussion, queries, questions, comments or whatever, very much about Dharma practice and not go wandering off into metaphysics and Buddhism and Buddhist politics and stuff like that. This is not really the place for that. So that was a very, very rudimentary framework. I don't know if people sort of relate to it in any way, but I think myself, the whole of Dharmic practice, however, whatever shade it may take, actually really does come back to those basic fundamentals. In terms of, you know, Dharma practice is about change. It isn't about understanding, mentally understand, oh, I understand this and go off and read books and listen to people talk. That has its place in the scheme of things. That's not to say that it isn't necessary or desirable, but it really is a skillful means, a really very much a preparatory, a way of focusing and orientating ourselves into what is something unique in our lives, which is the practice of the Dharma, because it doesn't relate to anything in the world at all, at all. It's very much the opposite direction. But when we've orientated ourselves, it then becomes very much something that we practice. And practice then comes away from our intellect and comes into the place where real change takes place, because that's why we're all here for. We want change. We want to be rid of suffering. We're tired of this enslavement to dukkha. And we want release, and we want to know how we do it, how we pull it off. And this is where the practice comes in. And the practice then moves, at least the way I see it anyway, it then moves out of the head primarily and moves into the body. And actually, the more we understand that, the more we will see that mind and body aren't actually two at all. It's not as if we leave our mind behind and we become these zombies. We actually discover that our whole mental faculty and our form are not two. They are actually one. We think that we live in our heads, which is this thing on top of our shoulders, and there is this body that's below that. That's a delusion, and that's really very much at the basis of our non-understanding, and helps to create the dukkha that we all experience. In fact, we are one, and the more that we can learn to integrate ourselves, nama-rupa. If you look in Buddhism, when it talks about body and mind, or body and consciousness, or the immaterial side, it always expresses itself as nama-rupa. And nama-rupa is hyphenated. They're not two different words at all, they're hyphenated, which means they're joined together. So nama-rupa are not two. We think they're two. This is our world of delusion. But nama-rupa actually are one. And the practice is about reintegrating nama-rupa, so that name and form, actually, we rediscover that it's actually all one. And when we truly discover, I mean, this may sound a bit sort of esoteric or whatever, but this is actually when we go beyond suffering, strangely. So that path, that journey, if you wish, of discovery, of rehealing, of healing that delusion, is primarily practice in the body, and is practice all day long in all the four postures. Because the characteristic of the Dharma is that the Dharma has to be nurtured in equanimity at least through all your waking hours. You can't turn the Dharma on and off when it suits you, you know, so that it becomes a hobby or a part-time engagement. Oh, I'll sit now, or I won't sit today, or, you know, whatever. We just seem to turn a blind eye to our practice. And just seem to engage in the Dharma when it's convenient. And the characteristic of the Dharma is that actually it's not interested in what you want, actually. The Dharma's not there for your convenience. And you can't just turn it on and off whenever it suits you. The Dharma is there ready to reveal itself to all of us, because the Dharma is inside of us. We don't make the Dharma, it's already there. We live out of it, only we think we don't, but we actually live out of the Dharma. And it's for us to rediscover what we actually are. But the Dharma will only reveal itself when you are prepared to engage with it wholeheartedly and completely. And that engagement means that we engage it in totality throughout the day. Every situation that we experience, from the moment that we wake up to the moment that we go to sleep. And when you truly engage with that and really nurture and cultivate that willingness, that spirit, that commitment, you will even practice the Dharma when you're in your sleep. That's not necessarily particularly important, but this is what will actually happen. And it's in that total engagement through commitment that suffering goes into change. But it means, it does mean a commitment, it does mean giving our desire to do it whenever we feel like it, always on our terms, turning it on and off like we're, you know, like it's a hobby, like we're stamp collecting or something. It's not like that. And this is why I really do try to, as a basis, as a framework, try to lay down the practice as a totality, and developing that total practice with equanimity through all postures throughout the whole day. And that totality means that we engage the whole of ourselves, our physical and mental, Namarupa. And if we go along that basic path, change will take place. It will. And if you really do stick at it, then very serious change can take place. But it requires that commitment, and I'm afraid there's no compromise with that. And if you're not prepared to wholeheartedly engage in the practice, then the change that you do experience, and change can take place, but given the potential of change, everything is relative, and the change that you will experience, which absolutely fine, is so superficial, is so rudimentary, so barely scratching the surface of what we're actually capable of doing through engagement. So if you get little tasters occasionally, little tasters where you forget yourself, and little tasters of freedom and space, and you think, wow, this is really wonderful, it is, but it's nothing to what you are capable of realizing, absolutely nothing. And in terms of becoming and rebirth and just being ensnared and trapped by this whole cycle of becoming, that won't actually have very much impact, really. It's when you go deep, that's when the real change can take place, and that demands your full attention, your full and complete attention. Which I'm sure we all engage in. So if anyone's got anything to say, comment or question or whatever, I think through questions and through tossing it around, we'll be able to tease out, or should we say put flesh on the skeleton, because there's an awful lot that can be said. But I think it's good, rather than just make this and I really struggled with this when I actually try to present something that actually isn't coming from a living sort of response. When people actually engage themselves with it, the whole thing can then come alive. To me, that first bit is very sort of two-dimensional, and I struggle like hell with stuff like that. So if somebody says something, it will come alive.
You talk about containment. Are you any broaden that out a little bit.
Yeah, well, we did touch on it. The containing, as I say, is very much, it's our emotional engagement, our emotional responses to everyday situations, whether they be very mild things, somebody's drunk the milk, or whether it's falling out with, you know, somebody very important in our life, or chasing after very powerful desires that we have very little control over. Anything. It's just a basic rule. There are not a whole lots of rules and a whole lots of ways. This is what makes this simple. There's just one way, whether it's whether the emotion is just a light experience or whether it's something very heavy, is that we learn to contain. The key to Dharma practice, the absolute essence of all of this, is our ability to have self-awareness. This is what sets us apart from the animals. We have that ability to stop and reflect and actually change our reactions to things. You know, a cat, when a mouse runs in front of a cat, the cat will jump on the mouse. It just follows its instincts. It doesn't really have any say in the matter. Whereas for us, if something passes along in front of us that maybe that we do normally jump on or run after, we can actually go, no, I won't do that now. I'm going to stop doing that. That's what makes us unique. And it's that, to me, it's the absolute jewel in the whole Dharmic practice, is that ability to just stop and create that space. That requires self-awareness. This is why it's crucial that we nurture this ability to be alive to ourselves in all situations for as long as possible. When we don't have that self-awareness, we don't have the ability to say no. We just react blindly. We just fall into that old habit that we've always had. Whatever it may be, we just do it mindlessly. We just do it like a machine. But with that self-awareness, nurturing that self-awareness, when we find ourselves in a familiar, let's say a familiar negative situation, where hitherto we go down a particular negative path, no, you just declutch from it. And it requires you to be aware, to retain your awareness. Because as soon as you lose your awareness, that thing, whoop, you know, it will be off before you can do anything about it. So that self-awareness, when you get an emotional charge that comes from a particular situation, retain it. Don't buy into that old habit of reacting. Now, mentally, you may not. Mentally, you almost certainly will still engage. Don't try to sort of force your mind. Because we don't really have a lot of control over our thoughts and the pictures. And actually, that's not a problem. It's engaging with them. If we leave thoughts and pictures alone, things rise and pass away, rise and pass away. It's only when they rise, we run after it, then we're off. We're creating we're in the world, we're living in the world, and we're creating all the karma that goes with that. But if you can just learn to be alive and stay with that which is the driving force behind that, these things will actually fall away. They will rise and they will pass away. It may happen quickly, it may not happen quickly, but if you stay in that state of non-engagement with that, it will go into change. Everything is impermanent and it will go into change. Now, in the meantime, in that containment, you are not denying yourself. This is very much a feeling of aliveness that comes with that emotion. Now, this is not, we're not pushing anything away here. We're not manipulating or avoiding, sidestepping, doing anything. We're just allowing it to be. Here it is. Without judging it, without becoming opinionated, putting labels on it, just live with it, just stay with it, give it space within yourself. And with that awareness, you'll become much, much more alive to that particular situation. You'll begin to quite naturally investigate it, just become alive to it and wonder and look into it. Even if you don't, I mean, to me, this is the pranya, this is the wisdom. Never mind if you don't have an insight practice. Wisdom the whole wisdom part of the path starts the day you take on this practice. It's not, you know, 5 or 10 years down the road when you become an order member that you start doing insight practice. Your insight starts at the day. Your insight practice probably started long before you've even come to Buddhism, because it's that that brings you to it, that awareness that something's wrong and you want to do something about it. That's the whole pranya part. And it shouldn't be sort of looked upon, give it sort of very low value. It's actually, it's deeply profound. It's brought you here. So in that containment, you begin to become very alive and aware of the world that you're creating. You begin to look at that and you begin to see how you engage with it, how you create the dukkha, how you turn that wheel of becoming, how the karma that you create for yourself and the destruction that you can do and the mess that you can make with those around you. So you're learning to declutch from that. And what you're doing is that you're actually stopping the paticca-samuppada from turning. You're going around to the craving, which is like this, and then you declutch from it and you stay with it and you begin to look into it, and in that looking in, as I say, you begin actually to get to know yourself. But because you're not actually judging yourself, you're not engaging, saying, oh, this is really bad, I'm a really horrible person, I shouldn't be doing this, da-di-da-di-da-di-da, you're actually just staying with something that's a part of you. And in that staying, what you're actually doing that's different from how you've reacted in the past is what you're doing is you are actually making friends with yourself. There is something there that you've always engaged with that's been negative, that creates that fragmentation of yourself that you then get into conflict with yourself and you begin to hate yourself or you hate others. Is there a difference between hating yourself and hating others? And what you're doing is that you're actually engaged in a healing process. Is that by not engaging in that conflict, whether it be with yourself or with other people, those two halves, as it were, that fight and bounce off of each other, that create all of this unsatisfactoriness that we experience. That slowly, because there isn't the energy input into that, those two halves, as it were, they will slowly come together. They will slowly merge and become one. And that goes for the whole, if we sort of could look at our whole personality, we'll see that we're all this infinite bits and pieces all bouncing around. We don't feel whole at all, we feel fragmented. And it's a healing process. The whole of ourselves all comes back into one. And that's all Dharma practice is about. And that's, you need that self-awareness. You need that ability to declutch and not fall into that old way. And that, to me, that's the samadhi aspect of the thing, because it's that awareness, that aliveness, that ability to maintain your concentration, just stay in there. You arrive at that point by practicing ethics, by your sila, by these experiences that you are cultivating your ethical practice by not engaging in negative things, and then by the looking into, by the containing and with the awareness, and then the looking into. That's the Eightfold Path. Those are the three aspects, the three limbs of the Eightfold Path. And in that looking into, and in that becoming alive and aware, and in that process of making friends with yourself, things change. On its own. You don't have to do anything. That's a natural process. If we engage in those things in our habitual ways, all we're doing is perpetuating that fragmentation. All we're doing is turning that wheel round and round and round and round, just creating karma for ourselves. It just goes in a circle. It just goes round and round. And just because your body one day falls to pieces and you die, don't think that's the end of it. I mean, this thing, you know, it's not that simple. This whole thing just keeps going, and it literally goes forever. because we feed it. We feed it continually. And with that, and with that awareness, and with that declutching, I mean, you know, even imagine what you're actually doing at that time. You are transforming the entire universe. You are transforming something that's been there forever and will be there forever. But you actually transform the profundity of what we're actually engaged in here is just awesome, actually, really, if you actually sit down and think about what we're actually doing. It's absolutely awesome what we're doing. But it comes from that self-awareness and that containing, and that containing and that whole experience and that whole aspect of practice that we're engaging, it's a physical experience, because you are holding on to that, driving it, go on, get out there, get out and punch them on the end of the nose, or run after whatever you want. That's very much driven in your body. And it's that whole energy that's got twisted and polluted and engages in all this nonsense. When that transforms and goes back to what is actually its original nature before it gets polluted, that's when the freedom comes. That's when the end of samsara comes. And we can all do it. And all we do is we learn to make friends with ourselves. I mean, how simple can you want it?
Yeah.
And that's what we then engage in, because we don't have that sort of relationship with ourselves. We are in conflict with ourselves. We are in conflict with others. And we discover that the reason why we're in conflict with others is because we're in conflict with ourselves. And when we get in conflict with ourselves, we get in conflict with others. So then you begin to wonder, is there any difference between that person out there and this person in here? Are they really two, or are they really one? And it's all about that conflict, and it's the learning to work with that conflict that we have. And the miracle of the Dharma is we don't actually do anything. All we do is contain it. We contain it and we look into it. And that will transform samsara. But as I'm sure we all are aware, that we don't find this easy, because there are lots of forces inside of us that are habitually caught up in that creating, and they're very, very powerful. They're so powerful that a lot of the time we can't actually contain it. It's so powerful. And that and those forces, there's a part of you that's brought you here today that wants this change, that is prepared to engage in this change. But there's also another part of you, a big part of you, that says, no, you're not going to do that. I'm not going to let you do that. And the other part of you wants to do it. And that's where the training is. That's where the practice is. That part of you that says, no, you're not going to do this, that's the bit that you learn to work with. And it's powerful and it's ingrained. It's very powerful, and it's very, very, very ingrained. And that's why it demands your full attention. You're not playing with a little, you know, I don't know, a little spider running across the carpet where you can just play and toss and, you know, take control of it very easily. You're dealing with, you know, a big, I don't know, a tiger, if you like. And you can't just engage with that whenever you feel like it. You've got to engage yourself with that and learn to work with that, little by little by little. And a lot of the time it will sweep you away. You'll fall over. And this is where your commitment then comes in, that you actually just pick yourself up and come back to the practice and not make a problem of that. Oh, I can't do this, I'm no good, this is too much for me. I'll go somewhere else, I'll go and try another religion or another practice or something or other. This is where the commitment comes in, and it's absolutely the bottom line in all of this, is your willingness to come back to the practice over and over and over and over again. Every time you fall over, to pick yourself up and come back and come back and come back. Because you're dealing with these incredibly powerful forces, and they will not give up just because you want them to go away or to transform. And this whole process starts with that containing. And learn to engage with that. And learn to declutch from your reactive ways, your reactive habits. It's not denial, it's not suppression. In fact, it's the complete opposite to that. Because what you're doing is you're actually opening to yourself. And, you know, we may have things inside of ourselves that we don't want to look at. Oh no, no, oh God, no, that's just too dark, too fearful, or just too unwholesome. I can't even look at that. I just gotta push it away and, you know, start whistling or go down the pub or something, you know, just keep it out the way. Through opening and containing, you learn to get familiar with that. You learn to accept it, and in that accepting and in that, you actually learn to make friends with that. That really dark stuff that we've all live out of darkness. We've all got darkness, whether it's just in the subconscious or whether it's in the unconscious. It's there. And the containing process, we actually begin little by little, learn to engage and open and make friends with that dark side. So there is no way is this anything to do with oppression or suppression. Nothing could be further from the truth. This is a willingness to open up to what we are and to learn to accept ourselves. And that's a long, slow journey. It's not something we can do by an act of will. But within that learning to do this, through all the postures throughout the day, this is where change takes place. This is where the wheel of becoming goes into transformation. And it's the third noble truth, that there is a way out, and this is the way. And we can all do it if we wish to engage ourselves.
Most of us have tried to do that in our daily lives. What I find interesting this morning is, as I said, your emphasis on the emotional aspect of it. But my question really is, how does that awareness of your emotions feel on a moment-to-moment basis for you? And that, I suppose what I'm asking is, maybe how do you do it? To engage fully on a moment-by-moment, is it an awareness that simply arises that is second nature?
For me personally,
yes,
well,
it's... engage and say, I'm here now, I'm feeling like this at this particular time.
It comes through the commitment, and it comes through habit. You just get familiar with it, and it just becomes you. You become it. It's not an objective thing that, you know, engage in some sort of a hobby. You actually become that. And it is about nurturing habits. This is, you know, a dharmic habit, if you like, a wholesome dharmic habit. And habits have to be learnt. And we have to learn to stay with and transform the bad habits, the ones that don't want us or don't allow us to engage in this practice. And it is about making it a full-time occupation, if you like, so that you become more and more familiar with it, so that you instantly see these things, you become instantly alive, because you've nurtured that clarity, that awareness. That is an insight. It's the process of insight. Awareness and insight are actually the same, but we need the awareness to put us on the starting block, and then that insight will naturally arise, and that comes through habit. And like I always say in these situations, I just say it all the time, it's about commitment. This is not a hobby.
Are you habitually checking in?
For myself,
is there a process of checking in all the time,
or well, it is a well for me. I assume a Buddha has perfect clarity and self awareness. I assume, But it is about just catching yourself continually, and that catching yourself and becoming aware of yourself is nurtured through commitment and is a habit, so that you just naturally come to it and you become it. It's not a, like I say, it's not some sort of an objective exercise, as it were. You're not learning in that sense, in an objective sense. It actually becomes your being. And the more you are aware, the less likely you are to be caught by things. It's as simple as that. You can learn to declutch. You learn to see it and just create that space. That's, as I say, that's the gem, that's the jewel. Once you get that space, when you got that space, anything's possible. When you don't have that space, you're just caught by circumstances, you're caught by habits, you're caught by your instincts. Look at an animal. Animal's got no, you watch an animal, it just follows its instinct. It doesn't have a reflective, I don't want to do this, I'm going to do that sort of thing. It just, things happen and they follow, and they're totally trapped by it. And we're trapped by it too. But if we're prepared to nurture that jewel that we've all got, we can learn to get into that transforming process. But as I say, the forces that we have to deal with that say, no, you're not going to do this, are incredibly powerful. This is the commitment. And without the commitment, you won't do it. And it is about making habits. I mean, to answer your question, it is about habits. It really is. But there are worldly habits and there are dharmic habits. And this is a dharmic habit. And all habits have to be learned. You learn them and you do them enough, it becomes automatic, as habits do. Only these are dharmic habits, and they're skillful means, they're upayas that bring you back to the Dharma slowly, slowly, slowly. And in that understanding, things change. Things go into change.
Just if you all know, we should be mindful and aware of things like that, and always being told this, but of course don't you get out of the room, or don't you put the book down and tell, so you start to get to this thing. So how do you try it? And you can say, yes, I'll really try, but then you lose it again. I'm just wondering if you've got any...
Well, only that the willingness when you catch yourself, nurture that catching. Just stay with that. I know that we can all, as it were, just lose ourselves. We can all goof off for several hours, and then suddenly, oh my God, Dharma! I forgot all about that. Whoops! Don't make a problem. Don't start turning and saying, "Oh God, I'm no good. I can't do this." That's playing the game. That's playing that mind game. That's playing that samsaric game. Is to catch yourself and come back to the awareness. When you sit every day, this is the great value of sitting meditation, is because we do set ourselves up in a contrived environment where we can actually concentrate more than we can do through the day. We restrict all the sensory input so that we do really hone it down and get familiar with that mental state. Get familiar with it so that you know it and it's there, and it's not a thought, it's not a concept in any way. It's something that you actually experience, and you know how you put the effort into staying with that experience, you know, for the half an hour or the hour, whatever it is you sit, that input, and you get familiar and you know it as one of your experiences, not as a thought, as a concept, but as one of your experiences, a familiar living experience. Come back to that. Just come back to that and revive that experience that you had when you were meditating, that you had that sense of aliveness. You know, there are no magic formulas with this. It's really just your willingness to keep coming back. That's it. And if you're not willing to come back, then it won't work.
think the point you made about wholeheartedness, I always, this word strikes me so.
Wholeheartedness.
In the whole practice, that I mean, it's a word that just has to be there all the
That's
time.
Right. It's all about wholeheartedness. You are dealing with such incredibly ingrained, unwholesome worldliness. And it's like we have to unravel ourselves, unpick ourselves, and it takes wholeheartedness. To just wholeheartedness means to be wholehearted in whatever you're doing, but the wholeheartedness also means the coming back, the coming back, the coming back, the coming back. And let me let you into a secret, or maybe you know this, but if you don't, because this is one of the things, one of the myths that's often cultivated in Buddhism and in Dharma practice. We do put a lot of store into this very peculiar word called perfection. This is very much a creation of man's imagination. It doesn't have any reality in the Dharma. The Dharma is not interested in being perfect or imperfect. That's just a worldly value. And we can often get this thing that somehow, oh God, I've got to be mindful. I've got to perfect my mindfulness in order to be enlightened. Or, you know, if you want to look at it in those extremes, oh God, I've got no chance of being enlightened because I'm spaced out half the day. That is a complete myth. You don't have to be perfectly mindful and aware all day long. What is absolutely important in this is your willingness to come back, to come back. That's where the whole thing turns on. It's not about being it's not about being perfect. That's just nonsense. That's just a worldly mind-made thing that we then make into a problem. I'm never going to be perfect. You don't have to be perfect. What's necessary is your wholehearted engagement, is to keep coming back. And every time you fall over, pick yourself up and come back. Don't make a problem out of, oh, I can't do this. Then you're playing the game. You're playing the worldly game. You're getting into that conflict. Just pick yourself up and come back. Fall over. Pick yourself up and come back. It's that commitment. That's where change takes place. And you don't have to be perfect by a very, very long way. It's in the commitment. And that commitment, that you've nurtured deeper and deeper, so that it's not just a mental, I'm going to be committed, but it's something that actually goes very, very deep within yourself. It's like that commitment, it's almost like a tool, like a fork, a garden fork, that you put right down inside of yourself, and you start to turn that fork, and then all that darkness and all that negativity and fear and stuff all starts to rise up. It's through the commitment that loosens it all up. It loosens it up, and then you deal with it little by little as it raises to the surface. So don't underestimate commitment. If it's a genuine commitment, it goes way, way, way beyond your consciousness. It goes right down inside of yourself. And that is the most vital thing within this. And it's the same, something that we're all familiar with. I mean, is a perfect example that, you can go to your meditation and you can sit there. Let's say you sit for an hour, you sit there for an hour and you haven't put 2 seconds of meditation together. You haven't been able to concentrate, you haven't been able to count to get to number two, never mind number three or number four. And you think, oh, what the hell was all that about? What an absolute waste of time. What a waste of time. And then you judge your meditation because somehow you think you've got to count to number 10, you see. We all think we've got to get to number 10. That's not true. That's a myth. That's a delusion. That's a creation of man's non-understanding of the Dharma. It's not the getting to the number 10 that's important. It's the fact, and you only get to number 2, and you think, what a waste of time, man. I could have been watching television. I could have been, reading a book. They'd be far more productive than... Because you think that you have to achieve. It's the fact that you are willing to go to your meditation cushion every day and sit on your backside and do your very best. That's where change takes place. It's not in the getting to the number 10. It's in your willingness. Okay, I'm having, you know, we have stretches where we just can't concentrate. We have stretches when things can come together quite well, and then we have stretches where things don't come together. And that's where the resolve comes in then. Oh, I won't bother to sit today because I know damn well I'm not going to get past number 2. So I might as well go and, you know, bake a cake or something, do something constructive. It's even if you just come and sit on your cushion and you just sit there and you just can't do it. That's where the whole thing swings on, is your willingness to come and sit, and not to judge your meditation. Because true change, dharmic change that takes place, real change, actually takes place on a deep subconscious level. And most of the change that actually takes place within this practice, for most of it, we're actually not aware of it. The real change is actually taking place right down here, right the way down. And it's that commitment to come back. It's like, as I say, it's like putting a garden fork in the soil and it's twisting and turning and it's moving the soil and loosening it up. And it's the willingness to keep engaging with that, coming back and as I say, using that as an example of a garden fork. That's primary. The ability to count to number 10 is secondary. If you can do that as well, great. Enjoy it while it lasts, because it won't last long, but enjoy it while it lasts. it's that inner conviction, that inner commitment. That's, and to me,